I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it an American conversation with global attitude. This one, our very last in the presidential reign of George W. Bush, is about one of the signature casualties of his era, the great city of New Orleans. The most remarkable American place, New Orleans, as our guest, the historian Ned Sublette, has written, the Crescent City on the mouth of the Mississippi is the only American town stamped forever by three colonial eras, first French, then Spanish, then Anglo-American. It was always the most African city in the U.S. in sound and spirit, also the most European in its names and its peopling, the most Caribbean in its commerce and culture, and, Ned Sublette writes, the most American, not least because it was for so long the pride of American music. The World That Made New Orleans, from Spanish Silver to Congo Square, is the title of Ned Sublette's prize-winning pre-modern history of the city. Ned, welcome back to Open Source. Your book helped me grasp that the peculiarity of New Orleans was built in, starting in the 18th century, in the Jefferson era, which was also the Napoleonic era.
Thank you, Chris. It's always a pleasure to be on Open Source. Yeah, New Orleans, like you said, New Orleans had the unique history of being a colony of three different imperial powers within a span of 50 years, no less. Mm. Within a span of 50 years, it was a colony of France, Spain, and I say Virginia. Mm. I mean, we talk about the United States, but really it was Virginia. More about that in a minute. But the city of New Orleans, which, you know, founded in 1718, founded because there needed to be a port at the Mississippi, and there still needs to be. People like to talk about it as a peculiar, eccentric city, and it is, but I'd like to see it as the logical outcome of competing imperial struggles. Hmm. The powers that clashed to control the commerce of the American continent found their focal point in New Orleans. France's hold on Louisiana was fairly thin. It never populated it that much. It gave up on the colony rather soon in its history. Then, in 1803, of course, the famous Louisiana Purchase, Napoleon took the city back over, took Louisiana back over for a period of 20 days, just long enough to flip it over to Thomas Jefferson and his men. And in 1812, the city became the Louisiana became the 18th state.
Remind us why Napoleon flipped it.
Napoleon flipped it because he saw that his chance to have a new world empire had disintegrated with the collapse of his dream of reinstating slavery in Saint-Domingue, the future Haiti. In other words, because his men were driven out after having died by the 10,000s in what is now Haiti as a result of yellow fever and black resistance. Hmm. Losing that dream, he realized he had to concentrate his forces elsewhere, and he also realized he didn't want the British to have it.
Ned, what is the, historically and even today, what is the mark of the Spanish grip on New Orleans?
The Spanish influence in New Orleans is, to me, that's really what the World That Made New Orleans centers on, is the Spanish era, which was brief. It was only about two generations long, but it was definitive, I think, in many respects in determining the character of the town. It was under Spain that New Orleans became a port of some importance. It began its 190-year relationship with Havana, a relationship that lasted until the imposition of the embargo by President Kennedy in 1962. Mm. And at this point, I will say something I always say when I have a chance to speak in public about this issue. The embargo of Cuba is implicitly an embargo of New Orleans. New Orleans hit its peak population in 1960, and there were many things that took New Orleans down in the latter third of the 20th century, but losing its trading partner of Havana was certainly one of them. The thing that I want to call attention to is that each of these three powers, the French, the Spanish, and the Virginians, had a different African world associated with them.
Let's talk about it. Yeah.
This is a very important thing to understand. They had very distinct laws for how enslaved people and free people of color were to be treated, what their possibilities were. And in each case, the community of color in New Orleans adapted according to the possibilities available to it. And then with each subsequent colonial regime, a new layer of people came in.
Spell that out. I'm thinking of the fact that in Cuba and in New Orleans, black slaves could buy their freedom. I'm also thinking that their music was different, freer. Their worship was different and freer than in the rest of the American South or the United States.
Yes, that's correct. The Anglo-American style of slavery was much different than the Protestant style than the style of the Catholic nations.
Interesting.
Going back to the different African worlds associated with the colonial powers, the French brought in Africans. About two-thirds of the Africans they brought were from the Senegambia, which is an Islamized region that has a very different music than, say, way down in the Congo.
Hmm.
It's, for one thing, it's heavily influenced by Quranic chanting. It's melismatic, that is to say, multiple notes on a syllable, like you hear in the blues. Bent notes, like you hear in the blues.
Hmm.
Swing time, like you hear in the blues. None of these are part of Congo music.
Hmm.
Okay. This was the first layer of African culture in Louisiana. We could call the French period the Senegambian period. Then under the Spanish, this shifted and they started to bring in large numbers of Congos. The Spanish had never wanted to have Senegambian slaves. They did not want Islamized Africans in their midst. They had spent eight centuries kicking them out of Africa. Carlos V had prohibited the importation of slaves from Islamized regions of Africa. So although some did wind up in the Spanish New World, they didn't want Senegambian slaves. One marker that I'm not just blowing smoke with this is that the banjo, which comes from the Senegambian region, is found in the French territories and in the Anglo-American territories and does not appear, as far as I've ever been able to determine, in Cuba, in the Dominican Republic, in Puerto Rico. Shows up in Guadeloupe, Martinique, Haiti, Barbados, Virginia. So there really are markers for this. We actually can trace this.
Hmm.
Then in come the Americans, and they bring in a much larger wave over decades and decades and decades of African Americans who are English speaking, born in America, raised Protestant, maybe with several generations of roots in the New World. And this is the infamous interstate slave trade. More slave ships came to New Orleans from the east coast of the United States than came there from Africa, in particular from Virginia and Maryland. This, I believe, is why the importation of slaves, why the African slave trade was stopped in 1808. The Virginians, especially, who had great political power, had a large number of surplus Africans to sell down south, and they sold at prices up to 10 times as high as the cheaper African imports that South Carolina was starting to bring in. So they basically stopped the cheaper imports from coming in. It was protectionism of their human product. This Anglo-American world coming down, colliding with a world that was already this Bambara, Congo, and everything else world that spoke French, spoke Spanish, with Canal Street in New Orleans practically as a national dividing line. This is part of the complexity of making New Orleans that resounds right up to the days of the world that jazz came up in. Thomas Brothers, in his book Louis Armstrong's New Orleans, tells an interesting story about how Louis Armstrong, who was from uptown, the Anglo-American part, the descended from ex-plantation slaves who had come in, who were dark-skinned and spoke English, who had come in the years after emancipation, Louis Armstrong knew Sidney Bechet. They knew each other as boys. Mm. Bechet was a Creole who lived down on the other side of Canal Street. Brothers tells a story that Bechet invited Armstrong to dinner one night, and Armstrong never showed, which caused ill feeling between – I mean, they were very young at the time, but this caused ill feeling between the two men for many years afterward. And then Brothers says something interesting. He says, but Louis Armstrong would never have gone downtown by himself at night. It was a different world. That uptown-downtown divide goes back to the earliest development of uptown by the Anglo-Americans. So all of this turf marking was already in effect at the time Louisiana became a state. Then there was one other very important demographic shift that transformed the city during the colonial years, and that was at the end of 1809-1810. In the final bloodbath of the Haitian Revolution, escaping the carnage, a number of Saint-Domingans had French free people of color and some enslaved people had fled the island of Hispaniola, Saint-Domingue, Haiti, whatever you want to call it, to eastern Cuba. In 1808, Napoleon invaded Spain and basically decapitated the Spanish government. That was Spain's greatest humiliation in its history up until the Spanish-American War. And Cuba remained faithful, and there was considerable fear that these French immigrants to eastern Cuba, Caribbean Cuba, would divide the island in two and take over part of it for their own French-speaking empire, the way they had taken over the western part of Hispaniola. And those who had not taken a loyalty oath to the Spanish king or married Spanish subjects were forced out. And in a space of about 4 months, a flotilla of some 10,000 refugees arrived in New Orleans. Most of them French-speaking, but they'd all spent 6 years or so in Cuba. About a third white, about a third free people of color, and about a third enslaved people. This is 1809 and 1810. This about doubles the size of New Orleans overnight, bringing in a whole different cultural vibe. Also, because by then the importation of slaves had been criminalized, they were not allowed to bring the slaves in. The slaves were impounded and kept on shipboard until an act of Congress authorized their importation. So those Dominican slaves brought into New Orleans, the 3,000-plus in 1809, 1810, were the last slaves legally imported into the United States.
Ned, you're talking about diasporas of all kinds, as probably nowhere else in this country, free, unfree, over a very concentrated time, and they produce a peculiar mix. Where does your imagination go in historical New Orleans listening for the mixes and for the sound of it?
Ooh, in every era, there are things that make you wonder, what could that possibly have sounded like? Of course, the great musical mystery of New Orleans is, what did Congo Square sound like? Congo Square was the big area across Rampart Street from what is now the French Quarter and what in the old days was the city. And it's never been built on. It's an open commons to this day. It was originally a market where the Indians came and sold items to the colonists, but very quickly Africans were selling things there too. And African women controlled the marketing in New Orleans, enslaved women. The fine ladies sent their enslaved women out to make the purchases, who purchased them from black peddlers also. So actually enslaved women controlled a lot of the market in New Orleans. At the end of the market day, there was a dance. And by the time that the Americans came in, this dance was several hundred people strong. And once the Americans had made regulations prohibiting dancing in other places at other times so they could keep it contained and controlled, Congo Square became the focal point of a whole lot of complex cultural exchanges among the black people of New Orleans from all sorts of points of origin. They would get 500 or more people on a Sunday afternoon. And Sunday afternoon is still music time in New Orleans today. It's when you have second lines. It's when you have Mardi Gras Indian practices. And, you know, 500 black people could make what Benjamin Henry Latrobe called a most extraordinary noise. We have some descriptions and even some drawings of it. The quote that most piques my interest is the one that I began the book with. On Sabbath evening, a visitor to New Orleans wrote in 1819, the African slaves meet on the green by the swamp and rock the city with their Congo dances. Rock the city, right? I mean, this is the verb, first known use of the verb rock to refer to African American music, right? And it's also referring to, it's not referring to the action of the body, it's referring to the action, the impact of the dancing on the city. You know, like many years later, the Stray Cats, you know, rock this town, you know.
Right.
They rocked the city, and it was also rock in the sense that it was loud. This was the only place in the United States where enslaved people were permitted to sing in ancestral languages, dance ancestral dances, play ancestral drums, and I really have to believe that it was there that a new kind of creolized African-American music was formed year by year, decade by decade. It's a marker not only of black resistance to cultural erasure, but also a French Creole resistance to American domination, because this is the kind of thing that would happen in a French or Spanish-controlled territory, but not in an Anglo-American territory. And it happened opposite the what we now call the French Quarter. It happened opposite the Creole part of town. This didn't happen in the Anglo-American part of town. It's very important to keep that in mind. Music is so much more than entertainment. Something I learned concretely at various times in my life, most graphically after the flood that took out New Orleans in 2005, is that after a rupture, when things come back and they're not the same, the new conditions will ultimately create new music. But in the short run, what you want is to hang on to your past. You want to find a continuity with what went before. The first thing we wanted to know after the flood was Fats Domino okay? Would there be a second line again? Would there be another jazz funeral? Would the Mardi Gras Indians come out on Mardi Gras Day? It was of key importance to the survival of New Orleans, not just black New Orleans, but New Orleans as a whole, that happened. Well, that is a small reflection of the feat that enslaved Africans accomplished in the New World pretty much everywhere they were taken. Some colonial regimes, like the Spanish, allowed them relatively more liberty to play their ancestral drums, practice their ancestral religions, sing in ancestral languages, dance ancestral dances. The Anglo-Americans were quite militant about prohibiting all of that, but even so, African-Americans under the Anglo-American system developed a much more implicitly African way of playing on the master's instruments and playing an Africanized American music. New Orleans it's an alternative American history all in itself. It was so important. It was so strategically important that all of these empires competed to possess it. They brought all of their imperial culture with them, not only the cultures of the masters, but the cultures of the slaves. There are three things I always like to point out in terms of the movement of music in and out of New Orleans. New Orleans was the baby sister of Havana, culturally in many ways. I see Havana as the fundamental music city of the New World. At the time of the American Revolution, Havana was a much bigger town than New York City. It was the great music town, the great dancing town, politically stable. Music went in and out of there, beginning in the 16th century. It had a creolized culture that began already in the early 16th century and began by the late 16th century, transforming music in Spain. New Orleans was Havana's little sister in a lot of ways, and the 190 years of constant communication between Havana and New Orleans, that's number one. That's very, very key. You find all kinds of things in New Orleans music that you don't find elsewhere, probably because of the relationship with Havana. But number two is, like I say, this great explosion out of the Haitian Revolution, that I've come to see the Haitian Revolution as one of the generative elements of pop music in the hemisphere. I'm still trying to get a handle on what that might encompass. I'll give you one example, though, a very simple rhythm, the cinquillo. Bum, ba-bum, bum, bum, ba-bum, ba-bum, bum, ba-bum, ba-bum. That's the fundamental rhythm of the Mardi Gras Indians in New Orleans. Bum, ba-bum, bum, bum, ba-bum, ba-bum, shallow water, oh mama. Shallow water, oh mama. That rhythm's virtually a marker of the San Domingan diaspora. And number three, the third big point for me in terms of the movement of culture is that traffic down from the upper south that brought in that whole other way of being musically black, that less explicit, more implicitly African way. And in New Orleans, all of these things combined, met up, intermarried, jammed at Congo Square. Congo Square was this meeting place where all kinds of tendencies might bump up against each other. And also, because New Orleans was such an important city and such an important port, music radiated out of there. It traveled back. Once people could travel back up the Mississippi, it traveled back up the Mississippi. It traveled to the surrounding areas. In the 19th century, there were three great music cities in the hemisphere, three cities with opera companies, right? Havana, New Orleans, and New York. Mm. All of this, the grandness of the musical city that was New Orleans long before jazz. There's much in New Orleans that's older than jazz. And the musics that go with the Mardi Gras Indians and the big parades, the ambulatory block parties called second lines, that reaches back to before jazz. That's what jazz comes out of.
Ned, you're talking about a cultural ecology so peculiar, so long in the making, so completely distinctive in its output. It's horrifying in a way to think of it being destroyed and being dispersed.
It's utterly horrifying to think of that. Now, the good news is New Orleans is still there. There's been a rebuilding party, and not everyone was invited. And it's a less black city than it used to be. But I can testify that there's still a community there and there's still music there. And I say that I've been in three transcendent musical moments in my lifetime. One was New York in the 70s, when the city was bankrupt and at its maximum period of creativity. One was Havana in the early 90s during the special period when the people didn't have enough to eat and were surviving practically on music, it seemed. And the other is New Orleans in the years after Katrina. It's just the commitment that's going into playing the music and is impressive. And the music that's being made right now in New Orleans is electrifying. And I really encourage everyone to go down there and participate. Go on a second line if you possibly can and get a sense of how important this, as you put it very well, this cultural ecology is. It's also a predictor of a battle that we'll probably be fighting for the rest of our lives, Chris, because our coastal cities are all imperiled. You look at these maps that are being made predicting what climate change and rising sea levels might do. One thing they might do is take out a lot of the world's coastal cities. And if you're a survivalist up in the mountains somewhere, I guess you can sneer at that. But coastal cities are our repositories of culture and history, because civilization grew up on the coasts, on seaports and river ports. Mm. Civilization is coastal. And if we lose that, we lose a tremendous amount of our record as a human race. This is a very serious, this is the serious cultural challenge of climate change, and we're seeing it happen right now in the battle to save New Orleans.
The other fascinating thought, and it may be consoling, is that New Orleans itself was the product of dispersal. It itself now is dispersed. But I wonder, I put it to you, where has it gone to?
Well, you know, there hasn't been very good follow-up on that. People have gone all over the place. The closer to New Orleans gets the heavier resettlement. The figures I heard as of last summer were that 72% of the city's population was back. That is, the city was back up to 72% of its population, not all necessarily the same people, because some people moved to New Orleans also. But African-American population, the best guess was 63%, which is to say that 37% of New Orleans's pre-flood African-American population was still in exile, either making new lives elsewhere and not coming back, or in many cases that I know of, still trying to get back and unable to so far. As to what the musical effect of this diaspora is going to be, I think it's probably too early to tell. I do think that the disaster of New Orleans in 2005 has focused the world's attention on the city's music in a way that it wasn't before. I think that the New Orleans musicians are traveling more. It's not an easy environment to be traveling in these days. And they're being paid attention to and thought about all around the world, I think, in a way that takes them a little less for granted than they were being taken in 2004 and early 2005.
Ned, have you come to terms yet with the loss of New Orleans or not? I notice also you don't use the name Katrina.
Yeah, I tend to avoid Katrina. It's a handy way to refer to it. Certainly everyone has an idea of what you mean, but it wasn't the hurricane that took out New Orleans. Those people in the lower ninth who died under the weight of a wall of water that came rushing in around their ears, the hurricane had passed the day before. They died under clear blue skies. Mm. It was a failure of the levees. It was an engineering failure that took New Orleans out. There was hurricane damage, but nothing New Orleans hasn't had before. But 80% of the city underwater, that wasn't Hurricane Katrina. That was a storm surge churned up by Hurricane Katrina. But the city was supposed to be protected from that, and that was a failure. And I just can't call it Katrina.
Ned, on the last day of the Bush administration, how do we want to remember the human failure here, the political failure here, as well as the engineering failure?
Well, personally, I'm sorry to see George W. Bush leaving office in a business suit. I'd like to see him in an orange jumpsuit, along with Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice, Gonzales, Rove, and yes, Colin Powell. I'd like to see them in Guantanamo, listening to the Red Hot Chili Peppers 13 hours a day in stress positions until they tell us who they were really working for. That's what I feel. But you didn't ask me that question. In terms of New Orleans, here's how I look at it. The drowning of New Orleans and the treating of its people as an insurgency was really the turning point in Bush's aura of invulnerability. After that, there was no way to pretend that this man and his cronies were not malicious clowns. That was the Emperor's New Clothes moment. And he should have been removed from office, but the Democrats decided not to do that and instead to take it back by electoral means. I don't think that electing Barack Obama makes up for what happened to New Orleans. I think that was too great. I think New Orleans paid a price that was too great to pay for that moment of truth about the Bush presidency. Looking back on the Bush presidency, we see that from September 11th to the flooding of New Orleans to the economic Katrina that our entire country now faces with multiple systems failing at once was all one big presidential vacation. And I would hope there is a full investigation. And I hope that the documents that Congress requested about the administration's response to the flooding in New Orleans, the documents Congress requested that have not been turned over, will get turned over in the near future so that we can find out what really happened.
We've lost so much, Ned, it's almost unimaginable. But to have lost this, as you say, and I think persuasively, this most wondrously, complexly American place is beyond heartbreaking.
It's still there, and we're still fighting to save it. We need to say that we need a few things. Number one, we need to close down the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, which is a lethal gun pointed at the head of New Orleans East and the Lower Ninth Ward. Number two, we need to get some wetlands protection out there. We need to rebuild some barriers out at sea to stop the surge before it gets up to the city. Will that even be enough in a subsiding city with rising sea levels? I don't know. But if we're going to try to save it, those are the first things we got to do. And we have to think about how to protect our cities and our culture. I think we all have to be involved in culture. And we all have to be involved in politics and in paying attention to what's going on. And I really do encourage everybody to get down to New Orleans, see it for yourself, hear the music for yourself.
Mm. No way not to end on a blue note, Ned Sublette. But what's the blues for this day?
I'm going to end on a different note. I'll give you a note myself, and it's not from a record. I'm just going to chant. But last second line I went on, second line's the big Sunday afternoon parades put on by what are called social aid and pleasure clubs, which are the affirmation that the African-American community still exists. They have never seemed so essential. Almost every Sunday in New Orleans, there's one. And they're really powerful, inspiring events these days, as well as, you know, a four-hour rolling party with beer and pork chop sandwiches and brass bands. The last one I was at, Young Men Olympians Benevolent Junior Association, Young Men Olympian Junior Benevolent Association, which first started parading in 1884. They paraded in three different centuries. They had six divisions, each one with its own band. And I heard the people shouting the name of one of the best-known bands in New Orleans. There's a chant that they do. Rebirth, rebirth. Mm. And were they supporting the band or were they shouting to their city? It was the same thing. Rebirth. New Orleans is a town where the blues aren't in quotation marks, you know. The blues in New Orleans is a very, like, literal thing. One of the things the flood did was make those metaphors come alive again, you know, high water, dark night, can't find my baby, all that stuff. It stopped becoming metaphors. They rehydrated, so to speak. There's a singer named Coco Robichaud who sings Saturday Nights in the Bars at the Apple Barrel on Frenchman Street. And when New Orleans was underwater and I needed to get up the courage to go out and start another day every day, I listened to a song by Coco. It's a sort of a non-specific gospel rock kind of number called Walk with the Spirit. It says, sometimes I walk all by myself. I don't want to talk to no one else. And I close my eyes and I feel the Spirit rise.
What's the music that takes us out in the spirit to suit our moment and our conversation?
Well, New Orleans got so many kinds of music going on all at once, and even today, there's a lot of music going on in New Orleans. But I kind of think that, you know, whatever anybody plays in New Orleans, whatever genre of music it is, and New Orleans is a town where the genres are notoriously plastic, you know, where the walls between genres don't quite exist. Everybody's playing funky music. There's just some New Orleans music has just got to be funky. So I'd say as long as you keep it funky, you're going to be doing all right. You might be playing some funky jazz. You might be playing some funky second line music by a brass band. You might be playing Big Sam's Funky Nation or Ivan Neville's Dumpster Funk or John Cleary's Absolute Monster Gentleman or any of a whole raft of other bands that I wish I could name them all. But there's still a lot of music in New Orleans. One way or another, it's all funky.
Ned Sublette, thank you. Thank you for your vast knowledge of New Orleans, past, present, we hope future. Thank you for joining us again on Open Source.
See you all down in New Orleans.
Thank you, Ned.
Thank you.
You don't want to hear your words repeated.
Paul McCarthy and Sarah Archambault produced and edited this conversation with Ned Sublette. Remember New Orleans with us in your own terms, your own associations, on our website at radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.